Okay, welcome everyone to episode 32 of the Academy of Management's Origin Series, the series where we bring you the backstory to Academy of Management review papers, what's gone on in the authors' heads, how they've evolved their ideas, developed them, and ultimately got them accepted to be published in the Academy of Management review. In this series, or in this episode, episode 32, we're going to be discussing the backstory to the paper, Uncertain Learning Curves, Implications for First Mover Advantage and Knowledge Spillovers. And so chatting with me are the three authors of this paper, Michael Lieblin, John Chin, and Hart Posen. And I'm going to ask them briefly to just introduce themselves, who they are, where they're located, a little bit about their research identity. And I just want to note that they did make a specific reference on the paper that this order of authorship is totally random. They each contributed equally to this paper. And so I'm going to allow them to pick and choose in what order they want to introduce themselves as we get into this paper.
Oh, now we're going to have a complex model.
We'll see who jumps in.
Michael?
I'm going first.
No, you're not.
I'm going first. The best looking guy goes first here. Thank you.
Yeah, this is not open source.
I am professor of management at the University of Wisconsin. I do work on models of learning and their implications for strategy and entrepreneurship. And in fact, before spending, you know, I actually got into this profession in middle age. I went back to grad school in my 30s. And so I was an entrepreneur in retail and tech before going back to grad school and doing something that is a heck of a lot more fun. This.
What about you, John?
Yeah, I'm John Chin. I'm at the University of Florida. I've been doing this kind of work that we have in this paper for most of what I do. Behavioral theories applied in different, you know, contexts. And I too was an engineer, non-academician prior to my role now. And I was, you know, like in wireless engineering. And after a long time, I'm starting to come back to my roots. And so that's some of my new work that's not like this, but it's some stuff I'm really interested in.
Cool. Thank you, John. What about you, Michael?
So my name is Michael Lieblin. I'm at Ohio State University. Most of my work is in the area of competitive strategy and strategic management. I've been focused a little bit lately on fundamental issues that identify whether a decision is or is not strategic, as well as this interesting stream of work Hart, John, and I have had on uncertain learning curves or behavioral real options, however you want to think about it. And an engineer as well back a long, long time ago. So
cool.
We all have a common background.
So one of the things to note about this paper is that it is a formal modeling paper. And, you know, we've seen a few more of these arise. I think under Jay Barney, he sort of reopened the door that we would invite more of these kind of papers and hopefully see a few more. And we're now starting to see them come to fruition or come to be published in AMR. So that's one of the things I want to just make note of as we get into this. I think it's particularly valuable to speak a little bit about the evolution of a paper that is a formal model, that has a formal model embedded within it, because it could be somewhat different to what other people view or see as a typical AMR paper. But before we get into some of that background, can you sort of give us a sense of, well, what is the essence of the paper, the sort of elevator pitch or the explanation of what's going on in this manuscript?
Yeah, I'm happy to take that, Greg. So for strategy scholars and more large, you know, this idea of learning curves are important. And this idea of a learning curve in strategy goes back to Mike Spence, who wins a Nobel Prize for different work, to Marvin Lieberman, to Pankaj Ghemawat. So really well-known scholars in strategy. And then the idea, of course, is you enter early to move down the learning curve to gain an advantage before rivals enter. And you're willing to take short run losses because they're long run gains. It's a very classic kind of strategy story. And our starting point is really the recognition that in that work, those decades of work, there's this implicit assumption. And the implicit assumption is learning curves are deterministic and known by managers. And this is a very odd assumption, which, you know, we've been reading this literature for years, didn't really recognize that it was being made, or recognize it was being made, but didn't recognize why it was important. And, you know, it's not an assumption because in a very different body of work on learning curves, the work that comes out of, Lindar Gaudi and colleagues, right? The fundamental story in that work is, boy, these things are highly uncertain. It's really hard to know what learning curve you're on. And she shows tremendous data and evidence of, even within the same firm, different learning curves across plants in the same firm doing the same thing. And so learning curves, she says, are these highly uncertain things. And so what we've tried to do here is to bring together this idea of uncertainty in learning curves and its strategic implications. And by thinking about different kinds of uncertainties in the learning curve, we saw there are certain kinds of uncertainties that makes the Michael Spence, Marvin Lieberman argument, enter early, take a loss, so you have long run gains, makes that argument stronger. But there are other kinds of uncertainties that actually gives you the opposite. You are better off waiting when there's uncertainty. So uncertainty plays a very, very interesting role in this story of early mover advantage that for decades we've been taking for granted or overlooking.
So one of the first things I learned when I did an MBA program was the idea of learning curves. And there was this thing that bugged me about them. And up until I read your paper earlier this week, I had never put my finger on it. And I think this paper gets to it, is that how do we know upfront how that learning curve is going to play out. And so I'd love for you just to double click on how have you framed or labeled and described these two different kinds of uncertainty? Because I think, you know, that just makes the essence of what you're saying, that there's this one that makes the learning curve more of a, being early on the learning curve, more of a strategic advantage, and this other that actually create some kind of cost. So what are those two kinds of uncertainty and how would you describe each of them?
You know, one is uncertainty about the future, right? How much will I learn this coming year? We call that prospective uncertainty, right? And that's the uncertainty involved in things like real options. What will the future look like? But you know, in a learning story, there's also this other uncertainty. It's what have I learned in the past to get me to where I am today? What do I know today? Now, for very simple kinds of tasks, you might know exactly what you know. But for many real world things, you're actually not only uncertain about where you're going to be, but you're uncertain about where you are today. And those two types of uncertainties in the learning curve have fundamentally different impacts on the kinds of behaviors you would see in terms of entering early versus entering later.
Awesome. I think that frames it up really, really nicely. So who's this paper targeted towards? And I'd love to know, you know, from a scholarly perspective, who do you think of as being the people to initially pick up and read it, and who might be more sort of on the periphery or find interesting from it? And then even from a, you know, how or where or when might it evolve into actually being part of discussions in MBA classes or exec ed courses? How do you think it could get into those? So I'd love to know sort of the multiple audiences and how we might reach those audiences.
Well, maybe that might be a question that's best served for me. I mean, I think all of us would agree that this is a fundamental issue. And to me, you know, part of my training very much was, what are the fundamental issues in the field of strategic management? How is strategic management different from allied disciplines, economics, psychology, sociology? How is it different from other fields, OB, international business, other forms of management that might be interested in this? I think we'd sit back and say, you know, again, this is a choice whether and when to invest in a new business, a new technology, et cetera, that it has both sticky components as well as uncertainty. as Hart just described about the rate of learning. And these kinds of decisions, I mean, this is going references back to Pankaj's book, Commitment. Our core to understanding strategy, in his view, in some of my work, you know, on what makes decisions strategic, it's also an element of that. So in a sense, I think we'd say that, or I think we'd believe that anyone curious about foundational topics in strategic management and their future evolution would find this paper interesting at a high academic level. But what we really do is, is speak to specific strands of that literature. I mean, so I think in some sense, the paper really sings to, you know, scholars. Hart, you can hum a little bit now if you want to sing.
You don't want to hear what I might.
You don't want to hear that. But the paper really sings to scholars interested in learning, scholars interested in early mover advantages, others interested in thinking about how we would extend real options logic from something, from a calculation to something that might lead to heterogeneous outcomes. So when I think of you, think of it that way. I mean, people who are interested in learning curves are likely to find this interesting because it helps us understand the sources and implications of different learning curve uncertainties and how those different forms of uncertainty affect action and, you know, or firm conduct and performance. If we're, you know, people interested in early or first mover advantages, there's a longstanding debate, you know, about early versus late mover advantages. Fernando Suarez has a series of papers talking about the half truth of first mover advantages. And I think what we do is effectively outline conditions under which uncertainty in learning curves can even lead to late mover advantages. So we sort of address some of that debate. And then I think, you know, as I mentioned, for real options, I mean, I think people interested in real options may find this interesting as we show how these different forms of uncertainty affect option value. So it's no longer just a calculation translating perceptions of uncertainty to a choice, but as Hart mentioned, with prospective and contemporaneous uncertainty, we're now starting to understand why different individuals might perceive the world differently, react differently, and then maybe enjoy different form. We might observe different forms of heterogeneity emerging.
And have any of the three of you tested this out with either MBA students or execs in sort of trying to teach or discuss the concept of learning curves and bringing out some of this nuance? And what's the reaction from them been like? Has there been an understanding and appreciation, or has there been sort of a, this is too theoretical for me? Any reflections on trying to do that?
Well, we certainly want to move beyond the math for the audience, but one of the benefits, you know, so I'm active in something called the Strategic Management Review. We have this nice advisory board of really tremendous folks. And so we get to talk to a lot of those individuals, and it's like, yes, I mean, this is incredibly realistic. This is an opportunity, you know, for us to get shed a little bit of light on, you know, what I think we already know, that there is these judgments about whether or not to invest. We've talked a little bit about building out simulations and models to see whether, you know, whether our training influences the way people react to different forms of uncertainty. In a separate paper, an earlier paper, we talked about how various forms of confidence affect responses to these sort of behavioral real options. And, you know, so there is a hope to develop and test a little bit of this in a laboratory setting in the future.
Cool. Yeah, let me add just one point quickly, if I can. It is in the earlier work that this work, current work builds on, you know, there is this idea that we've been pushing on of behavioral real options. And when we talk to folks about that, and that's really the mathematical underpinnings of what we're doing here, you know, there has been all this question of why managers and firms don't employ this options logic more broadly. And one of the things we've taken away is that when we talk about that options logic, we're talking about it as if you're in a finance options world where information is of a particular sort, this and that. And in fact, in the real world, it is not. And these managers don't think of the world in this. They won't use those excessively rational tools because those excessively rational tools somehow miscapture the world in which they're making decisions. So it is in that sense that we feel that there's something extraordinarily realistic, but also simple here that's very important.
And I will say that as someone who's not necessarily steeped in this literature and neither a formal modeler myself, that the paper
we can convert this, you yet. We
this this paper you. Is written in a very accessible way, such that I was engaged, I was reading it, I was understanding the flow. Now, when I get to the math, I've got to work substantially harder, but even without necessarily understanding or being able to peel back all the layers of the math, there's something particularly just fundamental to what's described in this paper. And so that's my encouragement for, you know, broad reaching strategic management scholars to say, there's something in here that is pretty fundamental. And especially if you're going to be either utilizing ideas around learning curves and or uncertainty in your own research or in your teaching, I think it's really worth paying attention to what comes out here. So can you give us a little bit of a backstory as to how do you land up writing a formal modeling paper for AMR about uncertainty in learning curves? Where did the genesis of the idea come from, and how did it evolve from that?
Sure, Greg. I think I want to go back to what you said maybe 30 seconds ago about, you know, the accessibility of this kind of work. So we'd had a previous paper that laid sort of the theoretical foundations of this options model. And that one, I don't know, it doesn't have the sort of application that this one does. It was just sort of like really fleshing out how these two types of uncertainty play together. And we focused maybe a little bit more on the math in some ways. And in fact, that's where it was in that paper where we, you know, figured out the derivations of the belief updating that are used in this paper as well. We also had a Journal of Management paper that was a little bit more applied to strategic factor markets. But I would consider that also, you know, in a different way, a foundational to this idea of feedback learning and optionality. And as we were moving forward, you know, a lot of the different sort of ideas that we had were trying to make this a little bit more accessible and applied, right? And learning curves is you know, they're so foundational in strategy that was a natural place to converge to. And, you know, we, as Hart mentioned, we began revisiting some of the early work in learning curves and saw this disconnect between sort of the more economic models like from Spence, which are formal, right? But they don't sort of tackle the realities of where these variations in learning curves come from that Argati does, where her work is more, maybe you can get your hands around more easily, but it's not formal, right? So in that sense, ours is sort of a middle ground that, you know, I don't know if this is overclaiming, but we're trying to solve both of these problems in some sense. so that's sort of the genesis of this work. There are other papers that we found that spoke to, you know, leading us in this direction too in the economics literature that I think we cite in this or the prior paper. Or both. The other thing I would say that I think led us to doing this paper is that, and I think you made some comments along these lines, this idea of a known learning curve rarely matches up with what we see and experience in reality. I was an engineer, as I mentioned, and a quasi-entrepreneur. And we experience learning curves in you know, our innovation. And I'm like, if you told me like, oh, this is, you know, you're going to go down this learning curve and you can, you know, invest $10 million right now and bank on it, you know, people would say you're crazy. I mean, we made it, we make a committed investment and we're far from sure whether that's going to pan out, right?
Yeah.
Even in our sort of, in our world doing papers, right? Same thing. You know, one way we sort of thought about this project was that early investments in learning sort of sprung up different options, if you will. options for future projects. And Greg, I'm sure you've experienced the same thing, right? Early investments in some sort of foundational knowledge lead you to say, hey, we could do any one of these four or five different projects. Yet once you commit to one of them, I think it's fair to say that having that paper accepted is not a sure deal.
Yeah.
Those are the couple of things when you put them all together, it's like, yeah, it really makes sense to go down this path.
But it's interesting that, you know, you spoke about utilizing this sort of real options logic and that influencing behavior, but then attaching it to this much more sort of foundational and fundamental concept of learning curves and almost reinvigorating it is sort of what I think gives this paper meat and accessibility and makes it more fundamental. And I've found some of that in my own work, theorizing work, is often it's about revisiting a fundamental assumption with a new set of apparatus or perspective or eyes and sort of combining the old and the new. And I think there's a little bit of that here, which is part of what makes it really, really interesting. And that there might be a tip within that for newer authors or authors who are trying to figure out a path to a contribution or publication in a theoretical article is sometimes it's about going back to some of the fundamental things and bringing them back in with some of our newer perspectives. So it sounds like a little bit of that went on in this paper.
Yes, yes. I'm glad you brought that up. And you're right. It was part of our thought process.
Yeah. So in my instance, I reinvigorated or reincorporated the idea of the organizational life cycle, which, you know, had been spoken about 30 years ago and no one had sort of brought it back. And then I said, well, maybe there's a connection with legitimacy. And lo and behold, it sort of brought out new perspectives. So that's cool. I really was intrigued to see this learning curve idea come up again. As you got into it, so it's clear that the three of you have worked on multiple things before, and this is one within a broader portfolio of projects. What sort of kept the momentum going or kept things interesting for you in this particular project? And what were some of your maybe internal practices that allowed you to keep things going and work effectively as a team? If you can give us a little bit of insight into what kept the project interesting and what kept you productive as a team in moving this forward.
Maybe I'll start. I mean, I do think, you know, there's an interesting origin story here. And I think this reflects on, I think, what you were asking about in a prior question. So this whole stream started, at least in my mind, what I remember, which is probably what is different from what everybody else remembers, but is we were all part of a conference and we were thrown together in a session on a sequential decision-making under uncertainty. And we had very different theoretical assumptions about how you would address sequential decision-making under uncertainty. And so all of a sudden we realized live in the session, I'm using one word for uncertainty and meaning something, and you know, Hart and John are mean something else by the word uncertainty, and I'm using one theory and they're using it. So we see this combination of different theoretical perspectives, options, and feedback learning with different conceptions of uncertainty, perspective and contemporaneous or noise. And we start thinking about ways to bridge these theories to, you know, what are the boundary conditions from each set of approaches? What are the insights we can generate? Well, that, you know, if we take one approach, if we take feedback learning, this is what we're going to learn. If we take real options, this is what we're going to learn. And, you know, it's that conflict that's been, you know, really, or that tension is probably the better word to use, that dynamic tension. So it's been so interesting. And then I think there's some, we have commonality across the three of us in terms of backgrounds, and we also have enough differences and frankness. Some one of us is, you know, incredibly frank in his way to chat. And so that always makes every conversation
fun to figure out. I don't know
that might be. We'll notice John no longer has religious artifacts in the back of his image, in the back of his room. And there's a reason.
I want to jump in here and say two things, Greg, in response to your question. The first thing is very close to what Michael said. You know, I remember that conference. This was at the old ACAC conference at Emory back in the day when that existed. But a short while after that, I was visiting Ohio State. I was visiting to give a talk. And not, after that first ACAC discussion, nothing much came up. We recognized there was something there, that there was a, something we couldn't quite put our finger on. I gave a talk at Ohio State, and afterwards, I'm meeting with Michael in his office. We'd never worked together. I knew him socially a little bit. And this, not the idea for this first paper, but the foundational idea in the SMJ paper from a few years ago, that is the engine for this current learning curve paper, that idea crystallized in the 30-minute post-talk meeting I had with Liebline. I literally left his meeting, and now he was my last meeting of the day. He had another something else. I went to a coffee shop, made notes on our conversation. That's kicked off this entire stream. So if I could encourage junior people in one way, you should see every talk and every meeting around a talk as a possibility to generate new research ideas. If I, when I go give a talk someplace, if at least one paper doesn't come out of that talk, that talk, I'm disappointed.
I take a different lesson. I think you just said junior folks should visit Ohio State to give talks here.
More specifically, they should visit you.
Well, yes, but of course.
Oh, that'll be a pleasure for all. But I want to say one other thing, and then maybe I'll kick it over to John here. And it is, you know, my interest more generally is around this topic of taking learning seriously. And by what I mean by that is, for years in strategy, we called them learning curves, but there was no notion we took learning seriously. It was just a deterministic drop in cost or increase in quality with every unit of experience. Okay, in one sense, that's learning, but it doesn't take the realities of learning seriously. And so what have we done here? We've taken the basic learning curve story in strategy, not Linda Agardi's story, which is a more OT story, does take it seriously, and said, what if we just took the challenges of learning? For us here, we embed these two uncertainties as two different challenges of learning. It's, what the heck happens if we do that? And lo and behold, a heck of a lot happens. And it for me, it provided a sort of a big leap in insight for me personally in the strategic implications of learning curves by taking learning seriously.
Yeah, I'll take all of our concepts seriously, right? And that's what's fun. We have the ability in our group to talk about that, talk about what we do and do not know about many of our theories seriously. Mm-hmm. Or frankly.
Yeah, and I'll speak to your second part of your question about what sustains us through the project, for me at least. There's one facet of it is that, you know, I had an interest in options, both real and financial options, prior to even starting a PhD. I just personal things like classes I took in business school. I have a very good friend who's a finance prof, and he often talked about options. And so my appetite was already there. I also did math as an undergrad, so I like doing the math. So, you know, I guess the message there is that it would have taken a lot for my co-authors to shake me off this project.
And we'd never do that, John. But I'd never do that. I can't speak for Hart. I would never do that.
But let me finish. So they, you know, honestly, though, they never really tested that boundary, because we do work quite well together. We have complementary strengths and perspectives, and none of us really get chips on our shoulders that easily and just hold grudges. I mean, if I might get a little bit personal, and it's worked great.
So yeah. Can you talk us through, and this probably requires you to think back a little bit, but how do you assemble a conceptual paper that relies on a formal model? What does, and working in a team? So there's three of you. You've got you're trying to get a manuscript out that's got a formal model in it. What does the ordering effect look like, or the process of writing and developing a paper like this look like? And I'm trying to untangle, in particular, you know, Rich McAdock has written quite nicely an editorial on okay, well, what are we looking for in AMR when it comes to these? But I think the back process of what does the process of developing a paper like this look like would be incredibly interesting. And I'm talking about getting down to the sort of like fundamental step-by-step. If you think about it, do you write the intro first and come up with the framing, or do you go to the model first and make sure you can get that tweaked and worked out, or what does the process look like? Can you give me a sense of that?
So, you know, I'll take the first crack at it, because most of my work are formal models. But
yeah, and you've had a few AMR papers, I think, Hart.
I have four model papers in AMR at the moment, either out or forthcoming. When that window of opportunity emerged finally after many years of AMR being not really a home for theory built using models, and this is actually worth saying, a model is a way of modeling, whether it's analytical or computational. Or any is a way of building theory. It's a way of building theory. So just to get back to your point, you know, we started with the end in the following sense. What did we want to say? A paper that just said that what Michael Spence and Marvin Lieberman said about learning curves and early mover advantage is right, and a model that shows, yeah, it's right, is an uninteresting and paper and unpublishable in AMR, and for good reason. So it had to be that if we're going to incorporate uncertainty in the learning curve the way we do, it had to say under some conditions the opposite. Now, we already understood our model because we worked on two papers with this model already, the core of the model already. We knew that we could play the model in our heads, right? We know what it'll generate. So really what we wanted to say about learning curves and uncertainty and how it changed the conventional wisdom of early versus late came right at the beginning, right? It's like anything else, right? You wouldn't go collect data on something if you had no sense of what you wanted to say. And a model is doing good modeling work is like that as well.
I would just add, I actually think it started in some sense, it starts before that with your education. If you're really taking, so a phrase that was used earlier is taking a concept seriously or taking a theory seriously. You know, so, and the three of us, I think, are inclined to do this for a variety of reasons, but you know, take any set of theories and let's take them seriously. And can I write it down? Can I graph it out? Can I be more precise than the verbal? I mean, you know, there's nothing wrong with verbal theory. That's actually highlighting a bunch of limitations in the analytics. But if we could write or graph something out and say what doesn't quite jive with what we're hearing from, you know, a business practice advisory board or MBA, executive MBA students or whatever, then I think, okay, now, how do we adapt that? And then I think that's when we jump into what Hart just shared, right? And that's how we sort of knew very early on what the basic insight was going to, what we expected the basic insight to be.
Yeah, and what I would say is that I would speak to, not to a particular paper necessarily, but how do you go about starting maybe a stream of work that looks at a type of core model. And so, you know, I don't have as much experience as my colleagues here, but I found in my experience that those are good things to have. When you invest upfront in a core model, and it's got a parallel in data, right? You don't want to collect data and have that just be for one paper, particularly if it's a very painful process. I think there's an analog for models too, where that the shape of the sort of the pace looked different in the first paper because we knew less about the model. A lot of the work was really trying to understand sort of the basic elements of that model and how can we structure it well so that it provides dividends going forward, right? Which is kind of a theme in this work, and also in another paper that Hart, I and Dan Elfenbein have been on, a stream of work on entrepreneurial entry and exit, has that same flavor, right? Construct a nice foundational model, and if you do it right, you know, it pays dividends.
Yeah, we chatted with a bunch of folks too. I think that was maybe that's yeah. You're asking about process.
So I was actually gonna bring that up, Michael, because in your acknowledgments there is a lot of people mentioned, and it seems like the development of this paper was not in a vacuum or in isolation, but much more of a social process. And so I was going to, I mean, what's interesting is the part of the paper is about feedback, and then in the actual writing of the paper, it's clear that feedback has been important. So there's a weird kind of parallel there. So I'd love to know more about, you know, the social process of doing this, and the different types of feedback that you get, and how you present and then incorporate, how you present to get that, and how you then incorporate that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've all been active in presenting our work at conferences and invited chats and whatnot. And this paper, as you mentioned, you know, we were fortunate to be invited to present versions of this paper on several talks. And, you know, during one of those early presentations at a school up north from Ohio, somebody, you know, was talking to me in the 30-minute session afterwards. And really saying, hey, tell me more about competition in our model. And let me, you know, how is competition and feedback affecting things? And that spurred a really nice extension to the core paper. And so and what that was more precisely, just to be clear about it, is, okay, well, what do we mean by knowledge spillovers? And consistent with everything I think we've said, you know, we try to say, okay, let's take what's a knowledge spillover. Let's take that seriously. What would that look like? And, you know, pretty quickly we, you know, find all sorts of, you know, literature talking about spillovers that might allow a laggard to reduce its initial cost very quickly relative to a leader, or a spillover that might allow a laggard to increase the rate at which it learns relative to a leader. But what came out is, like, you know, since we're talking about uncertain learning curves, there's a form of spillover that we had not seen in the literature. And it's this idea of uncertainty reducing knowledge spillovers from leaders to laggards. And then, you know, as we modeled that out, all sorts of interest, well, maybe not all sorts, but some interesting implications about these uncertainty reducing spillovers. And some of that are, you know, some of those are somewhat counterintuitive to what we think we know about the effect of spillovers from leaders to laggards on competition and benefits to leaders and laggards. So it was sort of a really interesting way of getting ideas and feedback from the community.
So two follow-up questions quickly there, and just open to any of you. Is there a good way or a productive way to ask for feedback on a paper? Very pragmatic. So you're sending this out to Jay Barney or Paul Adler. These are very busy people, very smart people, and you're asking them for some kind of input, because those are two of the names that are mentioned in your acknowledgments. Is there a good or bad way to ask for feedback? Let's get a response to that, and then I'll follow up with the second question.
So most of the, because I, you know, we give a lot of talks, most of this feedback came through talks. And I, you know, my advice there to junior people is to do the, as a junior scholar and PhD, they have a tendency to excessively defend. I take exactly the opposite approach in a talk. When I start the talk, I'm going to tell you what I think I don't know and want to help on. I'll just lay it out there. Here's where the paper is weak, and I want you to focus your attention in the talk. And then maybe when I meet with you afterwards, or even in your questions in the talk, you'll help me. You know, people are, I think our field and our endeavor is remarkably socially positive and communal. I think most people want to be engaged in this discussion that builds knowledge. And if you invite them in and you tell them how they can help you, I think people are I found, at least in my experience, people are remarkably open to intellectually engaging.
So take advantage to share your work in a talk sort of format. It's much easier and people find the time to digest it in that way. And when you do that, do it with a very sort of open and receptive orientation, as opposed to trying to defend your position or sell people on your ideas.
Tell people what you think the flaws are. They'll find other flaws. But who knows the flaws better than the authors?
Yeah. Right. And then what? So as a follow up to that, what about the R&R process? I see you make note of editor Healy Wang in the paper, and so you know what was helpful or productive in getting through multiple rounds of review with this paper, both just in terms of navigating the review process and maybe working a little bit with the editor in this regard.
Who should take this one? I'm happy to take it. Sure. You know, the review process at AMR has been just excellent. It's another thing about being open, right? It's easy to think, boy, what's wrong with those folks that they don't understand? But often the problem with, you know, the questions in the review process are, one should take it. Why don't they understand what I'm arguing? What is wrong with what we communicated? And I think the three of us together as a team share this view that if the reviewers or editors see something that doesn't make sense to them, there's a decent chance of something we did wrong, and being willing and open to do that. And we got very lucky in this paper. And in fact, for me, my experiences at AMR across other papers, universally good quality feedback that made substantial changes to the paper, changes in how we thought about the different kinds of uncertainties, changes in how we thought about competition, extending the model in various ways to different technologies. All of this came through the reviewers in the process. And I think it made the paper tremendously better. But I one other point, sort of in your question, but sort of not, is I was teaching a PhD seminar. Russ Koff and I co-teach a strategy PhD seminar here at Wisconsin. And this paper was in the seminar 2 weeks ago. And the students around the table asked, well, you know, what did it look like in the beginning? So I dug out the initial submission. And I put it up on the big screen, and I said, they read the introduction. And what they find, the introduction changed very little. And this is very, because it said, you know, we talked about the process of getting us there, and you've pulled us through that process. It said, boy, that core idea on the contribution was there at the very beginning. We didn't have to fight about was there a contribution, right? And so that persisted, but boy, the rest of the paper, and the, you know, you said how well we communicated these complex ideas in this paper. A lot of that credit goes to the reviewers who really pushed us to do better.
Good. So where to next? Like, what do you hope the impact of this paper will be in terms of influence on potentially future theory, or maybe actually empirical research, or even a practice or policy? What would you like to see as the sort of next utilization of the ideas in this paper?
Well, we already started on something you mentioned about sort of the policy implications. You know, one of the interesting policy implications could actually be in sustainability of green technologies. And let me explain that a little bit. So we've been actually working with a new friend in our modeling team, Mike Lennox, who's done a lot of work on sustainability, a lot of great work. And, you know, Michael and Hart are more familiar because they know the early history of this association, and I came on a little bit later, but it's really exciting because I think the idea of uncertain learning curves has rich applications to this idea of green technologies versus existing technologies, and it hasn't really made it there yet in that domain. But as one sort of teaser, right? Uncertainty in the learning curve can actually increase adoption of green technologies under certain conditions, which is not something you really think about, right? So that's kind of one of the directions we're going. Another direction that we're sort of looking at is with Jackson Nickerson and some of his work on adjustment costs and how that might play into technological disruption. So that's another area that is quite exciting.
Cool. Anything else? Any other sort of puns to get your ideas or work out there, or sort of encourage others to sort of feed them with potential sort of tidbits?
You know, I think for a long time, I'm a student of Dan Leventhal. So you know my view on computational models and the role of modeling in theory building. And I do hope that our efforts to bring this to an AMR audience, which is not a low cost effort on our part to do it, and maybe it's a high reward effort. But part of the reason for doing that is to say that, look, all theories should not be formal models. Absolutely not. But for certain types of questions in certain types of ways, there's a very, very important role for formal theory development. And it's not a substitute for qualitative methods, quantitative methods, inductive methods. It's not a substitute. It's a complement to that. And, you know, so some of the things that can come off this paper that the three of us will work on will be maybe other modeling applications like to green tech, but hopefully others who have a different bent will take this to the lab and examine how individuals or teams function and make decisions when they're playing some kind of game that has an uncertain learning curve. And so there's just so much room for the complementarity between different approaches. And, you know, I think that's something we'd all like to see. And I think it's something we've talked about and we would do anything possible to encourage and help along.
Awesome. Well, thank you to the three of you for sharing the backstory to this paper, helping us understand that this is part of, and I think it's important to note that it's part of a broader stream of work, these kinds of interesting, sophisticated papers that make a contribution, don't drop out of nowhere. They've got these often coincidental origin stories, but those origin stories are fed by people maintaining relationship, connecting with each other, continuing to share with each other. And I think that's interesting. And I think there's a few other very valuable takeaways. One of them that I took is that you don't develop a foundational model just once and allow it to sit. It becomes a something you can go and tap back into, allow to evolve, apply to different concepts, incorporate different ideas. And I think for anyone who's doing modeling, that's really important to take note of. And the second is the potential for going and revisiting old concepts with newer ideas and questioning them and examining some of the fundamental assumptions. And then thirdly, just the recognition that this is a social process. We've got to get out there and share our work and do it in an undefensive, kind of open, receptive way in order to allow it to evolve. So fascinating learning and insights and perspectives. Thanks for being part of the AMR Origin series. And please continue to contribute your great work to AMR. It's been fascinating talking to the three of you.
Greg, thanks so much for having us. Enjoyed the conversation a lot.
Awesome.
Great job. Yes. Thanks.
Thank you.